Could society manage if we didn't have a government forcing us to do things? Would everything descend into chaos if we didn't have our government masters superintending us? Or are there maybe resources in our human nature that enable us to adjust ourselves lawfully to one another, even when state enforcement is not looming in the background? We're going to talk today to an author who makes the case for no government and makes that case better than you might expect. Hi, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you from the Independent Institute in Oakland, California. And welcome to this episode of Independent Conversations with Professor Ian Scoble, author of the book, Deleting the State. Welcome to Independent Conversations, Professor Scoble.
Thanks. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. I should just tell our friends joining us that you are a research fellow affiliated with us here at the Independent Institute. And more importantly, you are the Bruce and Patricia Bartlett Chair in Free Speech and Expression at Bridgewater State University up in Massachusetts. And you've authored a bunch of other books, including one with the pretty fun title of The Simpsons and Philosophy. I won't sidetrack on that now, but sometime I'd like to find out about that one. So this book, Deleting the State, your argument, Professor Scoble, or Ian, if I may, your argument goes against pretty much everything that ordinary people think when they think about the government. I mean, people feel we got to have it, right?
Yeah. I mean, most people, when they think about the American Revolution, for example, the idea was, well, we don't want the King of England or the English Parliament to be our rulers, but we're going to make new rulers and we're going to create our own government. So the idea is, even if you think that particular government's bad, it means I want this other government instead. But there's some reason to think that we don't actually have to switch from this one to that one, but that we don't need any of them. There's a lot of qualifiers and caveats on that, but we'll get into that in due course. But yeah, the basic argument is that we don't actually have to have one, even though that's the default setting for most people's brains.
We're so used to thinking that way. It's just like it's a whole new thought to get your brain around. But sort of before we get into the details, and I just remind everybody that you can get this great book, Deleting the State, published by Independent Institute, and you'll get all the details that Professor Scoble and I may miss by reading the book itself. But for a starter, I thought it might be helpful to make it clear, which I understood when I read the book, that you're actually not calling for chaos, disorder, violence. This book is actually a second edition, originally published almost 20 years ago, and has new material, new introduction, new conclusion and stuff. But you said in passing in the book that the previous publisher from 20-some years ago insisted against your better wishes that the cover image should be what it was, which was a bunch of men aiming guns. And you didn't want that cover image. This cover image, as our friends will see, is more sophisticated. We have an eraser erasing an image of government. So explain, you're not calling for chaos, disorder, or men with guns, right?
Not at all. No, and I'm glad you brought up the issue of the cover because, you know, we all learn that we shouldn't judge books by their covers. But of course, often you can't help it. And the art actually is significant here. The first edition, as you noted, went with a photo of men with guns. But my specific point is that we can't actually delete the state with violence. So the new cover art is an eraser, erasing the picture of a symbol of government. And that's much more in line with the argument that I'm making. There's a number of reasons why we don't want to do this with violence, but the main reason not to do it is that that's the least effective way to do it. What that always ends up meaning is that some other government comes into place. There was a TV show a few years back called Designated Survivor. And the basic premise of the show was that, you know, some terrorist blows up the Capitol while the president and the Supreme Court and all of Congress and all the cabinet except the one guy is in the building. And so they're all gone. But that doesn't mean that there's no more government. That just means that they have to get new people in all of the positions of government, right? It doesn't matter how many people you kill, that's not going to get rid of government. It's just going to get rid of that person in that office. And then you're just going to get another person in that office. Why? Because people think that there has to be somebody in that office. The only way to really get rid of the state is if people change their minds about its necessity, about its moral legitimacy. So the only way to do that is through argumentation. You can't force people to change their minds at gunpoint. The only way you can get people to change their minds is by engaging in rational persuasion. So, you know, you can write books about it and hope to change people's minds. You can
talk.
Yeah, and talk. And you have conversations and you write stuff and you try to persuade people, this might work better than this. But you can't get people to change their minds by shooting at them. And so, you know, killing any number of people in the government isn't going to get rid of the government. Only changing people's minds is going to be bad.
Because your whole problem with government power is that it is, according to your account, intrinsically coercive. So you're not going to resort to the very thing you hate to make your argument work.
Exactly.
Coercion.
Exactly, yeah. Right.
So let just want to like brush that away. No, he's not arguing for disorder, chaos, violence, or anything like that at all.
Right. And it's not only that I'm not recommending violence, but I also try to dissuade readers from associating the idea that we don't necessarily have to have a government with the idea of chaos. When you say the word anarchy, a lot of people, what first pops into their head is disorder and chaos. Maybe they think of like, you know, G8 protesters throwing rocks at the Starbucks window or whatever, and we're rioting in the streets and this sort of thing. But the word anarchy doesn't signify any of that etymologically, right? It's just the negative making prefix with the word for archon, ruler. So just as the word monarchy means we should have one ruler, the word anarchy means you should have zero rulers. But there's nothing in that that means there'd be chaos, disorder. That's what many people think it means, which is why it's a hard sell. But one of the things that I'm trying to do in the book is explain why it doesn't have to mean that. And it's a conceptual mistake to assume that it has to mean that.
So your position would technically be labeled anarchism, but anarchism means what it actually means rather than this public misperception of anarchism.
Yes, although I'm really cautious about labels, right?
Yeah, because I noticed that.
If I lead with, hey, I'm an anarchist, people may assume wrongly that I'm in favor of stuff that I'm not in favor of, and then we're not even having a conversation because they've prejudged the situation. So in the book, it takes me, you know, lots and lots of time to get
right.
around
you, you
to
explain
what
it.
I'm doing. And when I'm having a real conversation with another person, I tend not to lead with the label at all, but just talk about, well, you know, what is it that you think we have to have in society, you know, and that sort of thing.
So somebody asked me off the street, so is Scoble an anarchist? My answer would be no, because I know what they mean by the question. But if like someone trained in political philosophy asked me, I would say, well, yes, in a particular sort of way.
Yes, I think that's the best answer.
So Ian Scoble's not in favor of tearing down buildings, but changing our ideas. Basically, that's what it comes down to.
That's correct, yes.
Okay. So here's how I sort of see the argument of your book in large terms, and see if I've got this big picture right. And then we're going to like dive into the picture a little bit. So it seems to me like you have two arguments. One's a more general argument for maybe a general audience. One's more particular. The general argument, I think, is that you're saying it would be possible, maybe even better, for society to operate without government, without what you call centralized political power. We'd have more peace, more prosperity, more liberty. That's a general argument that I want to explore. Then I think you dive into a little more particular argument when you're talking to people who value individual liberty already, but they still want to hold on to government for various reasons. And you say such people are inconsistent, you know, in their reasoning. So those seem like the two big themes. Have I got that more or less right?
Yeah, that's pretty much right.
Okay, great, great. So back to the general argument. This is the one where most people will stop and get hung up. You say that centralized political authority is not a necessary condition of achieving social cooperation that makes society possible. That's page 117, by the way. Possible. People are going to say, wait a minute. I'm like, what about all the stuff? What about all the stuff that we need? that we have to have from government, like what about police? What about courts? What about roads? What about emergencies? What about crises, et cetera, et cetera? Can you give us, can you address a few of the common objections, like stuff we need from government?
Sure. I mean, there are things that we have to have in society, and a lot of those things have traditionally been provided by the government. This makes a lot of people think that that's the only way that those things could exist. But that's not necessarily true. Just because something's traditionally been provided by government doesn't mean that that's the only way to get it. But even worse, some of the things that we think of as being traditionally provided by the government, in fact, were not always provided
by government. That's what I was just thinking,
like,
yeah.
That sort of came into being at some point, and now we think that. But if you go further back, in, so like you go back through 200 years, yeah, it was provided by government. If you go back 400 years, then it actually wasn't provided. So is it or is it or isn't it necessary? And that's a live question. And what's interesting to me is that that's simultaneously a philosophical question, but also a question for history.
It's an empirical
world,
question.
The actual history of the world. And so one of the things that I hope to show people is that we can sort of cross-reference the philosophical arguments with some real-world stuff about, you know, the history of law, the history of economic theory, and things of that nature, to see whether or not it's necessary. When you say something is necessary for something else, what you're saying is if you don't have that thing, you're not going to get the other thing. But there's ample reason not to think that about most of the things that people typically have at the front of their minds. Roads are the easiest example.
Yeah, roads. Let's talk about roads. Everyone thinks of roads.
Yeah, I mean, it's like people want to get from point A to point B. Somebody will have an interest in creating a road that goes from point A to point B. And many roads were initially developed just by people going in that route. Right. And so it's like, why is there a road from here to there? Well, because lots of people go that way. Maybe there's traders in the two communities, right, who want to exchange goods. And so there's frequent travel between those two places. Well, that's how you get primitive roads. And they say, well, you know, who would pave the roads? I don't know. I can think of lots of people who would have an interest in making sure that they were better roads, namely the merchants who depend on that road for their trading activities.
I bet that originally merchants all kind of went in together and said, hey, if we throw our money together, we could like pave a road and we'd all do better with our businesses.
Even if that's not historically true, you see that it's conceptually possible that that might happen. And in fact, many lighthouses, which is one of the go-to examples of something we'd never possibly have without government, were in fact funded by shipping concerns who wanted their ships not to be crashed against the rocks. But this is the cool part, right? In some cases, there's historical precedent for it not being provided by government. But in other cases, even if there isn't, it's certainly not something that's like, oh, I can't even imagine that that would. Of course you can imagine that that would be like that. Here's an example I like to use, and pardon me if this is a little silly, but it's like, I grew up in a big city where sanitation removal was a municipal service. So people who came by to pick up the trash were city workers. And so growing up, you could understand why I would assume, well, this is one of the things that the city government does. You know, they have police, they have firefighters, and they have the sanitation workers. So that's one of the things the government does. But, you know, now I live in a suburban area, and lo and behold, there's like five different private companies who are competing for my business to come by and pick up the trash. It's the same service. I'm going to come by X number of times a week or a month and pick up your trash. So obviously that can be provided not by a city government, but by competing firms who want to pick up trash in exchange for my paying the fee. And say, well, but now you have to pay for it. But of course, you pay for it when it's a city service anyway, because the city has to pay those workers. And so the city gets the money to pay the sanitation workers from taxes. So I'm paying for it if I live there, just like I'm paying for it if I live here. The difference, of course, is now I can price shop. And I can pick a level of service that's better for me personally, which may not be the same as my neighbor, and a pricing schedule that's better for my pocketbook, which may not be the same as my neighbor. And it seems to work just fine. You know, I'm driving around town and there's recognizable trucks from four or five different companies, and they all pick up the trash. So everyone's gotten their trash picked up, just like when I lived in a big city where it was a municipal service. So my younger self, assuming, yeah, this has to be done by the government, that's just wrong. It doesn't have to be that way.
So back just to roads, I'm thinking toll roads. Like toll road. I used to live in a part of Virginia where there was a toll road and there was a non-toll road. And depending on how urgent my trip was and how much money I wanted to spend, I would either choose the toll road or the other road. Right. And the toll road was privately owned and privately financed and collected the tolls and so forth. So somebody might say, well, we wouldn't have a nationwide interstate highway system if we didn't have a federal government making that highway system exist. Can you address that one? I mean, these are all very technical, simple questions, but...
But it's a counterfactual, right? In our actual history, the federal government created the interstate highway system. You can't infer from that that if the federal government had not created the federal highway system, that we wouldn't have one. That's logically fallacious, right? You can't make those sorts of counterfactual moves, right? It's true that that's how we got ours. It doesn't follow from that that that's the only way that you could do something like that. It's perfectly possible that a bunch of private road-making companies would end up connecting their roads together, not unlike the way a lot of railroads had their tracks connecting with each other, right? The railroad tracks were created by railroad companies, and there was lots of different railroad companies, but it was in their interests to have the tracks all connect up one way or another. And so you've got an interstate railroad network that didn't require the federal government to bring it into creation. So the railroads are like that, and it didn't come about that way. The highways are like that, and they did come about that way. So what can we learn about historical necessity? Nothing at all. Right? It's like it happened a certain way, could have happened some other way.
Let's go to some increasingly hard cases. I mean, sure. You know this pathway. I'm sure you've walked down it many times. Because everyone hears your arguments, they think, what? So one of those questions, maybe a harder one, is, well, so what about policing and courts?
Yes.
If we didn't have government police departments and then government-run courts, we wouldn't be safe from crime. We wouldn't be able to sue people when people harmed us. We'd be up a creek without a paddle. What are you talking about?
Right. So that's another case where what we assume has to be a government function turns out not to have originally been a government function at all. So I'm not original in making this observation, but people who have done work in the history and evolution of legal systems, right? If you look at the evolution, for example, of the English common law, right? This begins in local villages. The people who live together in these small communities have to find ways to work out how we're going to live together, how we're going to cooperate with each other, both socially and economically, how we're going to resolve disputes that may emerge amongst us. And sure enough, these villages all evolved their own ways of doing these sorts of things. And that would include what we would call policing against people who preferred to be predatory as opposed to cooperative. It's only later in English history that the crown sort of moves into that sector and sort of takes over the business of providing law and dispute resolution because it's revenue. It's revenue for the crown. It also expands the power of the crown. So if you're a king, you would like the idea of saying, no, I'm going to take care of all this dispute resolution, all this criminal policing. I'm going to do all that. It expands my power, and it gives me more revenue. So that's totally understandable. But all of the things that were happening first before the crown decided to move in and take over that sector. So again, we associate the idea that there's a court where we can resolve our disputes as something that the government has to provide. But if we look into the history and evolution of legal systems, we see that that's not true, that there's historical, not just that this is theoretically possible from a philosopher's point of view, but in fact, if you look at the history and evolution of these systems, that there's precedent for dispute resolution arising as a result of communities finding ways to live together and resolve disputes peaceably. Another great example of that is if you think about international merchant law in the Middle Ages, right? You've got people going from, you know, France to China to trade silk or spices or whatever. So they're crossing multiple jurisdictions. They're dealing with people from other countries. And yet they must have some way to work out their disputes. There's no international government in the Middle Ages. Yet these medieval merchants were able to figure out some way to know how to trust each other, know how to respond when trust gets broken. And they were able to police their own activities and resolve disputes peacefully because that's in their interests as international merchants. And the international merchant law today has its origins in these evolved codes that go back centuries. So this is true. This is true not only for international merchant law, but also, you know, for Anglo-American legal practice today. It has its precedents going way back. Like it's not like trial by jury got invented in 1776, right?
Right.
That was something that was common in Britain already. Why was it common in Britain already? Because a lot of communities had adopted that as a fact-finding procedure because it's superior epistemologically to,
even before,
you know,
the king trial forced
by
them.
Combat. Yes, even before the king forced them to, right? If you have trial by combat, that's not necessarily going to produce the actual truth of the matter. But if we present both sides of the story to 12 disinterested people, that's also not perfect, but it's a lot better than trial by combat.
Somebody might say, oh, well, yeah, history's fine, olden days, but it would be impossible in our day and age to have non-governmental policing and non-governmental dispute resolution systems, wouldn't it?
That's actually even funnier an objection, right? Because we actually do have non-governmental dispute resolution. Large firms that have labor management disputes, those typically don't end up in court, but at the American Arbitration Association, right? When the players' union and the owners of major sports teams have some serious problem with each other, that doesn't end up in court, right? That's typically done through private arbitration. Private arbitration is not only something that we have historical precedent for, it's happening as we speak, right? Where people find it's better to have their disputes resolved that way as opposed to going through court. Of course, you could also take it to court, but what's the idea of a court? An impartial third party to hear both sides of the dispute and try to figure out who's got the better claim. So you can have that happen through government provision, or you could have it done through the American Arbitration Association or any other of those sorts of firms. But the even funnier thing, of course, is that the people who work for the American Arbitration Association have to have a reputation for fair and objective procedures.
Otherwise, they won't get clients and they won't make money.
Yeah. If you're known to be biased, no one's going to agree to arbitration with you. But of course, if you go to government court, what happens if the judge there is biased, which happens all the time, but you've got no recourse. There's no recourse there, right? So what happens if you're a disfavored minority or you're accused of something that people are predisposed to dislike, even though it doesn't harm other people? The court might very well be biased against you, but there's nothing you can do about it. So if you're worried about, and this gets me every time, people say, look, if you have private courts, then you'd have these biased judges who'd always rule in favor of this one or that one. A, there's no reason to think that that's how that industry would play out, because that's not how the American Arbitration Association plays out at all. But B, like, that's the way it already is with the government courts. It's not like they're unbiased. They have their own biases too. And if your complaint is with government power, they're already not on your side.
You didn't yet mention, private police forces, because we have those operating now too in many places in the United States.
Sure. I mean, most universities have a security force of their own. In some states, that's a subjunct of the state-run police, but in other states, it's not. It's literally a private force. But in general, I mean, Bill Gates has his own bodyguards, I'm assuming. So Bill Gates isn't dependent on the state to protect him from having his rights violated because he's got, you know, paid bodyguards to do that for him. I don't, unfortunately. So I have to hope that there's enough police presence to protect me. But again, this is something that again, if you go back in history, was not traditionally a state-run service, but became a state-run service because that consolidates power.
You know what's interesting about the private police example? If private officers were allowed to carry guns, which they are in some jurisdictions, what they would not benefit from would be immunity. The way government police officers, they can use their guns to some degree with considerable immunity, whereas a private police agent, as it were, would actually be accountable for his misuse of his guns.
That's right. So clearly, it would actually reduce incidences of police brutality or excessive force complaints, precisely because they don't have immunity. If you're immune from any liability for what you do, that weakens your incentive to moderate your behavior. If you know you can be held accountable, that increases your incentive to moderate your behavior. So if you're worried about excess force or brutality cases or bias, you would actually prefer if these were private agents, not government agents.
Yeah, you would.
Because government agents can escape any consequences. They all have immunity.
So we're getting a whole series of examples of actually the no government solution can work more than we might have thought. I just want to add in passing that your new publisher, which is to say Independent Institute, published a few years ago a really interesting book called The Voluntary City, which I would highly recommend.
I have a copy.
Okay, yep. I figured you would. The Voluntary City is a book that contains a lot of detailed examples of this kind of thing where government is not necessary to provide the services. And in fact, maybe better, non-governmental may be better than governmental.
Yes, and the editor of that volume also has a standalone book on exactly that theme about mutual aid and you know, the idea. Because another thing people worry about besides police and courts is, you know, how are people going to fend for themselves if they're like were injured at work or something and they can't work anymore, or if you're killed at work, how is your family going to provide for itself? And you know, that author David Beito doesn't, and he's a historian, so he's done the homework, and he shows really thoroughly the ways in which before that was sort of taken over as a state function, people found ways to do that through either neighborhood ties or ethnicity ties or religious ties or occupational ties. So like forestry workers, for example, had their own mutual aid society. So everybody who was working in forestry contributed a little bit of their paycheck to this fund, and then you know Bob gets killed when a tree falls on his head, but then his family is taken care of by that fund, which is exactly what we expect Social Security to do today. But Beito shows convincingly, I think, that there's plenty of historical precedent for people just doing that voluntarily out of their own sense of this is a smart thing for me to do. I should be involved in this.
I'm upping the pressure. Okay, what about major emergencies? You treat this in your book like a hurricane blows through, everything is totally messed up. You need the government to come in and fix it.
Yeah. Again, for this, there's plenty of real world examples where private actors are actually quicker on the relief efforts than the government actors. So, like one of the hurricanes, one of the brewers retooled their brewing and just bought, bottled, water, drinkable water. And so you get these beer trucks driving into the disaster area with, whole truckloads full of beer bottles filled with drinking water.
Before FEMA gets there.
Exactly. And now cynical people say, well, that's, they're doing that for the PR benefit because everyone sees the logo of the beer company on the truck and the label of the beer bottle that's filled with the drinking water is like free advertising. It's like, okay, but it's still true.
Still water.
It's still drinkable water, which the people need. So it's better that somebody's incentivized to bring in the water. And I'm sure it's a combination of we need to help these people. It's not entirely this would be good PR for us. Maybe there's a little bit of that, but I'm sure it's also, hey, we need to help these people. Let's send them some drinking water. And then it's just a bonus that they get a PR bump from it. That can't be the only reason why they would do it, though, because that's surely more expensive than like buying another TV commercial, right? So they must also be wanting to help. And that happens all the time. But the other problem with thinking that we need the government to respond every time there's a disaster like a you know, flooding or a hurricane or something, people are subsidized to build in dangerous places because the government makes it more attractive for you to build, like, you know, houses on the floodplain get destroyed in a flood. And then what do? They build in the floodplain again. Why would you do that? Because it's artificially cheaper to do it because of subsidies to
Cape Hatteras.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. and so that's an example where government kind of makes it worse, right? Because they subsidize people continuing to do the dangerous thing. And then when the danger happens, which it inevitably does, they say, oh, well, we'll help you fix that. So you're simultaneously encouraging the behavior and then stepping in to fix it. I think that's a little bit weird.
It's like there's moral hazard involved in almost every government provision of services.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. Okay, another level up, and then I'm going to switch gears. Military. Who's going to protect us against the bad people overseas unless we have a government, army, navy, air force, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, so this is a little technical, and this is the one that's going to sound the most speculative, if you will. But people, if we start from the assumption that people are already going to be buying whatever private protection they are, right? It's like if we didn't have government-run policing, I'd still be a subscriber to some kind of private protection service. And again, you don't have to, if you're Bill Gates, you're doing that already, right? If you're a, you know, a person of regular means, you typically don't do that, partly because you already pay for your local policing. But if you didn't have anything like that, you'd buy your own the same way that we buy cable TV or sanitation pickup, to use my earlier example, or homeowners insurance, right? So you buy your insurance, right? So you why do you buy insurance? Because you want to be protected if something goes wrong, right? If you like if you live your whole life and your house never catches fire, does that mean it was a waste to have that homeowners insurance? Of course not, because you want the peace of mind knowing that if anything bad happens to the house, I've got the coverage. So if there were no state-run police, people would also have some kind of personal protection that they pay for, just like in the sanitation example. So if you start from the idea that people would have that there'd be several companies offering that kind of protection service, if your car gets hit, you call, Plymouth Rock or Allstate or whatever. But if you get robbed, then you call, whatever other company that does that sort of investigative service or whatever, protects your rights that way. So if there's people who have those sorts of arrangements with those kinds of companies, the idea is those companies would have consortial arrangements to provide larger scale protection. So if we had, all of these different private companies that protected people at a smaller scale at an individual level, and they would have consortial arrangements to produce larger scale protections. Like any individual person doesn't need a missile defense system, but a group of people spread out over, 800 square miles, well, they as a group would need a missile defense system. So that's going to come from, like one percentage of whatever your subscription fee for your regular protection goes to this larger consortial arrangement. And that's where the larger
against foreign military threats, even.
Or just the next people over, right? Because what if New Jersey decided to invade Ohio, right?
Right.
So the people who live in the area we now call Ohio, they're not only worried about the Chinese, they also conceivably be worried about people from New Jersey or Pennsylvania. But again, the local authorities, the local companies that they use to be their protectors would have consortial arrangements for large-scale protection. that's more speculative and theoretical, but there's no reason to think that that wouldn't work.
I think I would guess that you might say, if all that was left to government was like the Army, Navy, but everything else was private, it would be a huge improvement.
Absolutely. And in fact, that's an important part of my argument, right? I don't have any delusions that in the next couple of months, I'm going to wake up and everyone's like, yeah, you're right, no more government. Like, I don't imagine that that's likely to happen, okay? But we can use the argument that I'm making that it's not necessary historically and not justifiable morally as a sort of a guidepost, a North Star, to think about what the limits of government should be at all, right? One of the hallmarks of the classical liberal tradition is that we don't want absolute monarchy, right? We want to have limited government in some way, okay? What are the parameters for the limits of government? I think we can use the fact that, assuming I'm right, that there is neither historical necessity nor moral legitimacy for a centralized coercive power. That's what sets up the parameters for thinking about what those limits are. So even if, if you say, look, Scoble, anarchism's unrealistic, that's never going to happen. Okay, I'm sure you're right. But that doesn't mean that it's not worth noticing that we don't have to do it that way, because noticing that we don't have to do it that way shows us what the limits should be. So like you said, if we only had police and courts and the military, that's much better than the way things are now. Right.
We have some people who are with us on the program as viewers and have written in some questions. Here's one from someone named Anthony, who asks, how far can anarchy scale up? He gets it in small communities and so forth, but could it really be scaled up to the level of, a nation the size of the United States?
I don't see why not. I would wonder what the reasons for thinking that it couldn't scale up. I mean, the argument is when people live in greater degrees of peace and prosperity, that just leads to greater increases in peace and prosperity, right? So it's like if this group starts doing it and then it gets more popular and it gets more popular and it gets more popular, I'm not really sure why it wouldn't scale up. Now, there's even if it did scale up to, like, let's say everybody from Maine to California decided to go this way, so that if we drew a line on the map around what's now the USA and say, okay, well, these guys are all anarchistic, right? But Canada and Mexico aren't, and Russia and China aren't. It's, oh, okay, fine. How are we going to deal with those other people? Ideally, through commerce, right? And if we deal with the other people through commerce, that's not something that's likely to lead to gunfire. If they decided to be unpleasant, then I suppose we'd have to defend ourselves in the manner that I was just speculating about a moment ago. But hopefully, it would be more of a commercial interaction. Because we're interacting commercially as opposed to like trying to conquer other people, that's exactly why it would scale better, I think.
Here's a question from someone named Jack. Why do almost all persons believe, mostly unaware, in government as a god without considering its inherent immorality? Why do they believe in it?
Yeah, well, it's a great question, right? People, I think the fundamental mistake that people make is it's not that there's something wrong with the idea of centralized coercive political authority. It's that the wrong people have that power. So if we could only have the right people having that power, everything would be great. But as the question suggests, the key word there is people, right? Whoever you put in those positions is going to be another person. So maybe it's a good person, a virtuous person. Maybe it's a horrible person, someone who's only interested in having power over others, exploiting their office for their own personal gain. People are people, and some of them are good and some of them are bad. But if you think, well, look, it's fine if we have this office that has massive power, because if we get good people in it, they'll do good. Right. But that means if you get bad people in that office, then they'll use that power for bad. This is exactly why in Lord of the Rings, for example, right? The good guys realize that they can't use the Ring of Power because that's going to corrupt them, right? And this is actually a story as old as Plato, long before Tolkien thought of it.
Ring of Gyges.
Yeah, it's like if you had absolute power, you know, you would probably find yourself corrupted by it. Even if you started off with good intentions, I'm going to use this power to do good, then you're going to end up using the power not to do good. And even if you don't, the next person who has that power very well might. And so I think people really need to stop thinking there's nothing wrong with power. It's only a matter of getting the right people to have the power. I think it's a lot smarter to just not have that much power in the first place.
Yeah, that's a pretty profound observation. It also suggests to me ways in which your thinking is similar to and different from that, for example, of the Federalist Papers. In Federalist 51, Madison apparently was the author of that one. He said, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. But to paraphrase, since they're not, the first job is to have the government control the government and then to control the government itself. So his thought about human nature is pretty pessimistic, which is related to your point a moment ago, namely that you can't just say, we'll get good people holding the levers of power and the levels of power will be great. But since good people you can't count on that. In fact, you can count on the opposite. Then just don't have so many levers of power would be your and his, except his view still holds on to government and yours doesn't.
I think that's because, I love the point that he's making there, right? But he seems to have assumed that the paper structure that they were creating was filled with enough robust checks and balances.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That the institutional framework would be a limit, a built-in limit on people abusing that power. And I'm respectful of the work that they put into coming up with that, right? It's a great idea. I think we've got a couple hundred years of evidence that it didn't work out according to plan, right? Executive power seems to have gradually increased, like literally from Adams to today, right? A gradual increase in executive power, despite the fact that the document's not written to work that way. So the assumption would be that the legislature would be this hard check on executive power. But I think what they overlooked was that it turns out it's in the legislators' interests to give that power over to the executive, right? It actually makes it easier on them in a number of ways if they just push that power off and say, sure, let the executive have these kinds of powers.
What a cop-out.
Yeah, and it makes it, like, if you're perpetually up for re-election, it makes it, like, hey, I'm not responsible, blame the president, right? It's like it gives each legislator plausible deniability, lack of accountability, right? They can always say, hey, it wasn't my idea. If it works out, great. Hey, I supported the president on this. If it doesn't work out, great. They say, hey, blame the president, not me. Right? So they actually like giving, and this is what Madison didn't think of, they like not having as much power as he wanted them to have. It's better for them in this tangible way if they cede that power to the executive.
So the balanced checked system would turned out not to be sufficient to fend off the downside of power.
Yeah, so I think that's true.
Your difference with Madison is he's saying, well, we'll have the levers of power, but they'll be kind of divided up. And your argument is just don't have so many levers of power in the government to begin with.
Exactly so.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So in some ways, James Madison and Robert Nozick have something in common. Well, they're both deceased, but they both valued human liberty, but they both held on to minimal government as a necessary component. So I won't make you argue with Madison anymore, but you did spend some time talking about Robert Nozick, the late Robert Nozick, who was what I might call a minimal government libertarian as opposed to a no government libertarian. So why was he inconsistent with his own thing?
Let me preface my remarks by saying that I have a tremendous amount of respect for that book. And
I know you
I agree with most of what he's doing in that book. But I think he's missed a step when he argues that because it's possible. He argues it's possible to imagine a state arising through this gradual building of consortial arrangements that I was describing earlier to evolve into something that resembles the minimal state without having violated anybody's rights. And he infers from the fact that you can tell a story in which this is possible to happen, that this is what would necessarily happen. And so therefore, we're going to get that minimal state, and that that's a good thing. I think that that's like the one mistake in the book, or maybe one of two mistakes in the book. And I think it's, he takes the argument that I'm making seriously. I mean, he starts off by saying, look, you know, these individualist anarchist types, they've got a point, and we need to take that seriously. We can't just blow that off. We can't be dismissive of it.
But
that's true. But mm-hmm. And he says, here's why I think we don't have to worry about that so much. Mm-hmm. And I do think that he's missed a step in that argument.
Another way maybe of putting your argument with regard to Robert Nozick is that if Nozick is correct to uphold individual liberty as the supreme public good, then to be consistent with that, he shouldn't have embraced even minimal government.
Yeah, and another thing too, and this is a little bit inside baseball, but I think that the argument that he makes in the very beginning part of the book about why we would have minimal government is actually not consistent with the argument he makes at the very end of the book, where he talks about, you know, the idea of having, so the only thing that could count as utopia would be a framework in which people could form any sorts of communities that they wanted. And those communities would all be very different because people are all very different. But as long as you aren't forced to join any of these communities and you can leave any of these communities whenever you want, then that's all we can expect out of utopia. And that vision, the vision that he paints in the tail end of the book, is actually very consistent with the argument I'm making. So I may not actually end up, maybe Nozick doesn't disagree with me after all, right? It's possible that by the time he got to the end of the book, he was describing the reality of a society of maximal liberty as one of, you know, what we shouldn't call, but really is, anarchism, right? It's like we've got just a bunch of different communities, and they're all voluntary communities, and no one has to join any of them, and you can leave any of them if you want to. That sounds like the sort of thing I'm talking about. So maybe we don't disagree after.
Maybe not. Maybe not. Boy, I'd like to dig deeper here, but I think I want to take a little segment here toward the end of our discussion. There's a question from someone, a viewer named Nicholas, who said, are there any examples of a stateless order or something approximating it that are positive? And I think you've given some, actually, in the course of your discussion. One of the ones you gave was on page 72 of your book, where you mentioned the experience of the American West before the federal power moved in to control, regulate, and so forth. It is pretty fascinating when you look at the American West during that period after the Louisiana Purchase, but before federal power came in to overlay everything. People like to call it Wild West rugged individualism, but actually, it really wasn't just rugged individualism. It was a bunch of people cooperating with one another voluntarily, setting up patterns and systems and water systems and enforcement of rules and so forth without anybody forcing them to do so. They sound like pretty cooperative people rather than rugged individualists.
Just so. The so-called Wild West turns out to be, you know, sort of like this is what we think of because of watching movies or TV shows about the West.
I like the movies.
I do too. I teach a course on Westerns. But gunfights are more cinematically interesting than people sitting around a table discussing how to deal with problems that they have.
I need this water. It's up. I need the water. You're upstream. I'm downstream. Let's figure this out.
Right. And so, and again, I benefited tremendously from actual historical research by other people who showed these sorts of things. Economic historians who look at the development of these non-state-based social orders that emerged in areas where massive government influence was not yet felt, right? And so any sort of frontier situation, right? The people going there are far, physically far from whatever the center of power is. So, you know, like in 1850, you know, on the East Coast, there was government and all that stuff. But out in the, you know, what's now Montana or whatever, there really wasn't. It was just the people going out there had to figure out how to live together. And just like in medieval English villages, lo and behold, they figured out ways to live together, work together, recognize each other's rights, enforce dispute resolution, all on their own.
Human beings can be pretty amazing in some circumstances. Now, you point out in that part of that chapter that once the federal power came into the American West, the incidence of violence and crime went up.
Of course, yes.
That was an interesting empirical point, I thought.
Hey, I thought so too.
Here's a couple other examples. One thing you didn't really address in the book is the notion of a nation. A nation would seem to be a people who have a lot in common and aggregate and associate together over time and history and so forth. But can nations exist without states? Here are some examples that I thought of. Tell me what you think.
Sure.
So for example, before Garibaldi, Italy was a nation but not a state yet.
Exactly, correct.
Before Bismarck, there was a sense of German national identity before Germany was assembled as a state. Contemporary examples are closer to Poland. Poland has a great history. It didn't always have a state, but the nation always existed without a state to reinforce it. So during the period from 1795 to 1918, at the close of World War I, Poland didn't exist as a state, but it did exist as a nation. And then Kurdistan, there is such a thing as a Kurdish nation. There's a little bit of a Kurdish state in northern Iraq, but there really isn't a Kurdish state, but there's an extensive Kurdish nation. And most important of all, in my mind, the Jewish people. There is such a thing as a Jewish nation. There was before 1948, there was a Jewish nation. The whole question was, shall this nation have a state for itself or not?
That's right.
It acquired one. So all these examples seem to be show the natural existence of human association into nations, which didn't always, or maybe still don't, have states. Does that fit with your argument?
100%, because people form their identities through a variety of associations. And so, you know, we associate with people who may share like a language community, for example, or a faith community, for example. And then we feel drawn to people who share those things. And there can be cultural aspects of that beyond language and religion that make people feel associated with each other. On the flip side, though, it's like thinking about American-ness, right? People emigrate here from all over the world. And so we often associate and like think of each other as, you know, fellow Americans because we, you know, like the Declaration of Independence or like baseball games or, you know, whatever other things about American, you know, cheeseburgers and big cars and like whatever it is that ties Americans together. You know, it's some argue that it's a creedal nation as opposed to an ethnic nation because we all believe in, you know, all men are created equal and certain inalienable rights. And like, so people who come here tend to be into that. And that's what establishes our identity. But again, with the what people learn in school often, well, I mean, I'm an educator, so I know how this works. People learn stuff, but they only learn half the stuff sometimes, right? So little kids learn in school, here's Italy, here's Germany, whatever. And at some point they were told that there didn't used to be an Italy or a Germany, that these are relatively recent developments, but they forgot that part. And so we think, well, of course, you know, French people live in France and Italian people live in Italy and German people live in Germany. But it doesn't, it doesn't have to be like that. It often, as you point out, isn't like that.
The emergence of the existence of stateless nations is a pretty fascinating study. And also, it also has another angle, which I just thought I'd mention. So Polish nation without a state, Kurdish, Jewish nation before it had a state, and others. These nations coalesced not primarily, it seems to me, by the calculation of individuals figuring out what would best be conducive to the protection of their individual liberty. These are aggregations that people were maybe born into, that they didn't necessarily make an autonomous personal choice.
Yeah, I think that's true.
So that kind of human association seems to be very conducive to stateless government, even though it's not rooted in the calculation of individual interest.
Sure. I think that's right.
Well, anyway, this is a really fascinating discussion. I would encourage our friends to go and get this book by Ian Scobel, Deleting the State. He answers so many questions that I couldn't even pose to him today, although you answer a lot of my questions really well and really concisely. But he does even better in the book, I suppose, more extensively. So find the book, order it, Deleting the State. Ian Scobel, you're doing the world a great service by exploring ideas about stateless governance that most people can scarcely get their heads around. But with a little help from you, maybe they will.
Well, I certainly hope so. Thanks very much.
Happy to have you on Independent Conversations here at the Independent Institute. Wishing you all the best, and thank all our friends for joining us today in this conversation. Join us again on Independent Conversations. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.